Welcome to Minute 5 of the Great Escape Minute Podcast, a daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Rob.
Today, it is Friday. We are talking about Minute 5 of the Great Escape. Minute 5 starts with the POWs coming into the camp, and it ends with Henley checking out the security perimeter of the camp. So first thing I want to talk about is just one of the best shots, in my opinion, of this film. And that's where we get this look at, you know, all the POWs come in, but then we pan down and we get this look at the fence as Henley's coming over to look at it. And the way we get the music and the way that shot is done, it just makes it look so much more intimidating. Because, I mean, we start the shot, you know, we see the barbed wire at the bottom of the frame, but we're looking over it, getting a clear view of all the POWs. But as we move down, it's shot in such a way to make the fence seem incredibly tall. And then it's shot at an angle, too, so it just, we're looking through multiple layers of barbed wire now into the camp to see Henley standing looking at the fence.
Actually, it's Ives.
I have Henley. Yes, it's Ives. Henley written in my notes for later. Yes, it's Ives.
Yeah, it was Ives, and it's a good contrast because of the fact that Ives is, you know, he's a tunnel man. You know, he's a short jockey. You know, so it makes it even seem more intimidating the way that they film this. I mean, as you said, the panning shot is great because you first see everyone enter the camp and you don't see the barbed wire, or you don't see the fence and everything like that. And then it slowly moves down, and as it's moving down, you know, the fence is creeping up on them. You have the barbed wire, and then you have the fence, and then, you know, and then it just, I actually think that this is great. I mean, it's a little bit of a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen this before, but it says a lot about Ives and his future fate in this movie by showing, you know, he's walking briskly, and then he's taking a look, and when he sees, you know, how tall the fence is, you see his face slightly, you know, look downward, and, you know, in a few months, we'll probably get to that one. We'll discuss, you know, what happens to his fate, what his fate is in this movie. It's just done really well. And again, it's nice to be able to notice other, characters in the background. You know, you have Ives walking, and this scene, or this part of the scene focuses on Ives, but you see Kevin just walking next to him, and you see some of the other, recognizable characters who don't necessarily have names. Actually, you can see the tailor, Griffith. You see him looking around also. You know, this whole minute gives us an impression, the first impression of these prisoners of this new camp that they've now been brought to.
The three they choose, I find it interesting, the three that they focus on, because we start with Ive, and then we get Hill walking and looking at stuff, and then we get Henley. There we go. That's where Henley was coming from.
Correct, yeah.
You know, and so we get the three of it. It's just interesting that we get the three of them are the ones we see, you know, the close-ups of looking at, okay, where are we? What is our situation? Which, with Henley, I find interesting, just given his role. It doesn't seem like he would be one of the ones checking it out.
No, I actually have to disagree with you on that one. I think that I mean, a little later on they mention about Henley. I think we'll talk about next week or maybe even 2 weeks from now. You know, when Hans Messer is discussing with Ramsey, you know, who the various prisoners are, you know, how many escape attempts they've all made and whatever. And if I remember correctly, he mentions, or he alludes to Henley also, along the way. I could be wrong. I mean, we'll get to that in a few weeks and we'll see it at that point. I think this is trying to establish more the idea of the fact that Garner and McQueen are the stars here.
Yeah.
I think that's the idea here. I mean, Attenborough hasn't been brought in yet. So, you know, Big X is still not in the camp. So what they're basically showing here is they're showing Ives. I think Ives is the first one they show, partially because of the fact that he has a lot to do with the whole idea of tunneling and of escaping and stuff like that. And I mean, they mentioned a little later on that Ives actually tried jumping off the truck on the way. You know, he's someone who just needs to get out of there. So you know, he would be the first person to look in. You know, he's trying to find a way of getting out, and then he looks and he's a little despaired by what he sees. Hiltz, on the other hand, you know, he's walking and he actually picks up some of the dirt on the ground, which I found to be quite interesting the way that he does it, because he picks it up as if he's like a pitcher.
Yeah.
You know, you have a pitcher on the pitcher mound, you know, who's going to pick up and, you know, rub some dirt in his hands before he's getting ready to pitch. And that's more or less what this scene looks like. I mean, again, it's just a quick, maybe 10 seconds of Hiltz. You know, he's walking along, he's carrying his duffel bag on the way. You know, he's looking at the ground, he's looking, you know, how he kicks one of the pylons in the ground just to see how strong they are. He looks up at the guard, you know, to see if the guard's paying attention. So I think that was interesting the way they showed that. And Henley comes and he's looking around. He doesn't touch anything. And what I found very interesting was is the way that he's looking at the different guards. The guards don't really look like they're paying much attention to what's going on. You know, they're like, okay, no one's going to try and escape from this place. I don't need to. I mean, none of them are touching their guns at all. I mean, obviously for safety reasons, you know, you don't really need to. One of them's tapping his gun. You know, he's patting his gun with his hand, but none of them are in a position where if someone were to try to escape that like in 2 seconds, they'd be able to get to their guns.
Yeah, I think the one at the last guard we see, he's not on his gun, but he just has this look on his face of, if you're going to try something, at least wait till I'm off duty to do it. He just looks so
exactly
fed up with being there.
Don't bother me. And it's like, well, come on, as anyone who's done guard duty before, most of the time, it's pretty boring anyway. You know, you don't want to be there. So in this particular case, you have guards who don't necessarily want to be there, you know, right. And it shows because, you know, they just have to sit there. They probably think that, oh, I have to be a babysitter instead of, you know, actually doing something, more important for the war effort or whatever it is. So I found that to be interesting. Also, we get to see one of the numbers on the barracks. We see barracks 109, which is the one that's the closest to the fence on this side. I don't recall right now I think 109 was one of the ones where they dug a tunnel from, because it's so close. I don't remember the numbers at this point. We'll get there in a few weeks. Yes. when we discuss the actual which building, you know, where Tom, Dick, and Harry come from. But yeah, I mean, the guards just look very unsympathetic for everything that's going on. Like we mentioned, they just don't want to be there.
Right. And I do think I have questions about Hiltz's costume this entire movie.
I have a feeling you're not the only one who has that question. This is not an American pilot's uniform. It's Steve McQueen's version of what an American pilot would look like. You know, give me the leather jacket. You know, give me the blue sweater. You know, give me the baggy pants. You know, that's it. You know,
I feel like I don't even feel like it's that. I feel like that's just what Steve McQueen wore to the set that day.
It's very possible that's what he did. Yeah, that's. I mean, I know a lot of people have a lot of criticism about the way that about a lot of things that Steve McQueen does in this movie. I mean, I do too, but it's still fun to watch.
Oh no,
you know, that's the important thing. You know, we're not looking at this and saying, you know, okay, is Steve McQueen is his costume and his character the perfect fit for the situation? Probably not. Is he the perfect fit for this movie? Yes.
Yeah.
Because again, he's able to add a lot of comic relief and keep things, I mean, in general, this story shouldn't be a very upbeat story.
No.
But they actually were able to find the balance between giving us a serious drama and throwing in a lot of comic moments to lighten things a lot, not even just a bit, a lot. And I think that's probably one of the criticisms that a lot of the people who are connected to the real story had against the movie, because here you're taking some serious situations where, you know, 50 of their family members or friends or countrymen, however you want to look at it, you know, were murdered. And to make a movie, they just decided to take away a little bit of the poignancy in this type of story. I personally, you know, since I don't have a personal connection to it, I can easily say this, but I think it makes the film work even better because of the fact that it has this perfect balance between these things. Because, you know, if you're going to watch Schindler's List, for instance, okay, it's a very downbeat film. Yes, it's an amazing film. It's got a great message, great story, and everything like that. But it's not one that you're going to walk out of and be cheering. This is a movie where it takes place around the same time. It's still dealing with you know, with stuff that happened during World War II, you know, there were atrocities that were committed. And what it basically comes down to is that in order not to bog everything down and make it so sad to watch, they found interesting and unique ways to make things more enjoyable, more entertaining.
Well, and I think what works for that, and going to tread slightly carefully here because I in no way want to compare being deployed to POW situation. But what I have found is you get a group of military people in a confined situation where you have, you know, that type of force camaraderie and, you know, you're just spending 24/7 together. You end up finding new and interesting ways to break the tension that, you know, isn't necessarily brought up too much in film. And I think this movie tries and to a certain extent succeeds in trying to bring that to light, that these guys' outlook is, you know, not good, but they're able to, because of the relationships they build within it, have a sense of levity at time because of it.
Right. No, I agree with you with that. I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that this was one of the first real ensemble movies. I mean, when you look at the cast, which again we're going to be discussing over the next few weeks as we start meeting some of these characters and stuff like that, a lot of these actors were big name actors at the time, and to throw them all together and say to each of them, okay, you're not the main star, you're not the main star, you're not the main star, you've got an important part in this movie, okay, and this is your job and this is what you're going to do, and we're going to give you as much to do as possible. But on the other hand, they still needed to, they wanted to show the camaraderie between all of these actors. You know, it's not an unknown fact that there are a lot of actors who can be difficult to work with. Steve McQueen is known to have been on that list, but they wanted him in this movie. They wanted to make him happy in order to make this movie work. You know, in a few months we'll be discussing the whole motorcycle scene and everything like that, how obviously that didn't really happen. And that's something that really pissed off a lot of the people who are connected to the real story. You know, Steve McQueen said, this is what I want to do. And this is, if you want me in this movie, this is what you're going to have to do. And they said, okay, you know, we want you in the movie, so we're going to add it. And even though that whole scene is a complete fabrication and it never really happened, it's just so fun to watch.
Yeah, it's still just a really cool motorcycle jump.
Exactly. And again, as we said, we'll discuss it in more detail in many, many months from now when we finally get to it. You know, I think that has a lot to do with it.
Did you have any other notes for this week?
No. As I mentioned, I think yesterday, or maybe it was even on Wednesday, I don't remember which day, we mentioned this. The fact is that these first 5 minutes of the movie, there is no dialogue at all. You know, we're only given visual keys of how to look at every one of these characters. One of the actually interesting things that I read was is that one of the things that Elmer Bernstein did with the score is he actually gave, I guess, mini scores, or however you want to. Again, I'm not a music expert, so I don't know how to really describe what you would call it. But each character has his own tone of music also, which helps set, you know, each character away from the others. So I think that's going to be interesting to watch and listen to along the way also. And this minute where we actually get to meet three of the characters, even just minutely, so the music helps there also with that. Wow, you know, I'm just rewatching this minute and I see someone walk by with a trombone.
What?
Yes, I just saw one of the prisoners walk into Hut 109 and he's carrying a trombone. I guess they had a whole band there. You know,
I mean, they have a whole choir later, but
no, the choir, yes. Wow, I never would have thought that Stuftwaffe 3 would have their own marching band. You know, you have a guitar player and you have someone carrying. Once again, I'll tell you what second it's in. You know, I have this playing in a loop as we're discussing it, and I just happened to see it. Where is it? There it is, 42. Do you see that? Anyone looking? If you can go to minute 4:42, you can actually see one of the characters carrying a trombone into barracks number 109. Wow. Do you see that?
Oh, yep. I see it now.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a trombone.
That's just amazing. I it always makes me wonder, you know, how these things happen. This is something that that prop guy says, okay, I'm just going to give you a trombone and walk along with it. Or is it something that the actor himself said, oh, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to show that, I mean, again, we discussed this earlier, that, you know, these guys, it was because yesterday, I think, that these guys jumped out of planes or whatever. Where the hell does a guy get a trombone from? I was concerned how someone got a guitar, but here you got a trombone also. I think a guitar would probably be a little more common, but to have a trombone in the middle of a German prisoner of war camp, wow, that's just something. That's crazy. You see?
Yeah.
That's why these minute by minute podcasts are great, because you get to watch a movie in so much detail and you get to see things that you never would have thought of seeing before. Wow. That's just amazing.
Well, I don't think we can beat some random person holding a trombone unless you've got any more notes you want to cover today.
I think that's the way, that's a great way for us to end this first week. There's no question about that.
So go ahead and rate us and subscribe to us on wherever you get your podcast. If you want to reach out to us, thegreatminute@gmail.com is our email address. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. We have a Facebook group called The Cooler, and on Twitter we're at GreatEscapeMXM. And join us Monday, and we should have guests to talk about minute 6 of The Great Escape.
Tally-ho. Tally-ho.